Okay, I wanted to share some different little stories with you, and the reason for this is more of an encouragement for you guys. Because, and the thing that I found interesting is the unknown opportunities I get exposed to. And this is a perfect example I'm going to share with you on this. My company, part of what we do is install storage equipment for car dealerships. So I hire people to work for me, subcontractors, and they're installers and all this kind of stuff, and movers and everything. Well, this particular installer, I had hired him to put in equipment over the years at the companies I work for. Well, we're riding over to Alabama, and I share my Ghanaian story with him because he's got a company, and he's a wealthy man. And he had told me, he said, you know, Gary, he said, once I get a few things done, there might be a way that I could financially help you. He's not a believer. But he said, you know, this is a noble work, and my children need to understand that we who have a lot need to share. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily for the same reason we believe, mm-hmm. but in the humanitarian side of the process. Okay? So, I said, man, that'd be great. Well, lo and behold, following year, March of last year, 3 days before I'm fixing to get on a plane and fly to Ghana, I get a call from Michael, and that's this contractor. And he says, hey, Gary, I met a guy from Ghana that you need to talk to. And he says, I was doing a big project for one of the big hospital systems in downtown Atlanta, and would you mind giving him a ring? So I said, send his phone number. I'll call him. So I call him up, and his name's Peter Stevens. And Peter's sharing with me, he said, Gary, he said, I heard about what you're doing with the literacy work in Ghana and the schools and everything. He said, is there any chance I can meet you so I can get a better understanding of this? I said, well, I'm pretty tied up. But I said, here's what I'll do. I'm flying to Ghana Saturday afternoon at 5 o'clock. I'll be at your home in North Atlanta at 10 Saturday morning, and we'll meet each other and talk. And then I got to go to the airport. So sure enough, I go to his house, and we get talking. Well, at that point in time, he was working for the Grady Memorial Medical Center in Atlanta. And he had this vision about trying to get medical help into Ghana to raise the medical standards, because that's the industry he's in. Well, and he's got a commitment from Grady Hospital to offer training to Ghanaian doctors to come over and train in their trauma centers and all that kind of stuff. And he's got a semi-working relationship with Emory University. He's got a relationship with Morehouse College. And he said, I'm from Ghana, but I'm a U.S. citizen now. I came over years ago. And he said, you know more about my country than I do.
Exactly.
So I said, okay. He said, would you mind? He said, I can't seem to break through what it's taken to get us set up legally to operate in Ghana with the government. Mm-hmm. So I said, matter of fact, I'm going over to meet with our attorneys when I fly in. I'm going straight to the attorney's office. Because we have our own charter. We're set up legally with the government. We can move money. We pay taxes. Everything's legal. Mm-hmm. Render under Caesar type thing. Mm-hmm. So in any case, I fly over, I submit the paperwork, I help kind of get things going, and I come back, and Peter said, hey, Gary, would you mind sitting in on some of our board meetings? We're meeting with the CEOs of all these companies that are Grady and different ones. So I said, sure, I'll sit in and try to help explain it. Well, you know, we're kind of rocking along, and I'm just trying to help, like I'm here, you know, type thing. Well, lo and behold, I get a call from Peter during the summer. He said, Gary said, my mother in Ghana, she's very sick. She's going to pass away anytime. I'm going back to Ghana. This is in late July. I said, well, let me ask you something. I said, I know the deal with funerals over there. It's going to be a long, drawn-out affair. How long are you going to be? And he told me, so I'll be there 2 weeks. I said, you think you can get a leave of absence, stay another week? If you can stay another week, I'll fly to Ghana, and I'll meet you, and I'll show you Ghana, what's really going on. So I did. I jumped on a plane. I fly over. And in the meantime, during this thing, Peter had called me and said, hey, Gary, what are you doing this Saturday? Well, I work a lot of Saturdays in my business, so I said, happened to be off. He said, can you come over to Emory University because the vice chancellor of this university, I showed you the picture, is in town. He's going to give a speech. I said, sure. I go over there. And lo and behold, I'm just going to sit at the back of this big auditorium because they got all these speakers. They got them there from Saudi Arabia. They're there from Pakistan. They're there from all over the U.S. They're from Ghana. They're from these big humanitarian efforts for being represented at this big global health organization. So I ease into the back of the room where, lo and behold, they come get me and walk me right down to the front and set me right beside the vice chancellor of the university system of Ghana. So needless to say, I mean, not to be unkind, but let's face it, I'm the only white guy sitting with this whole entourage of men, very distinguished men, and vice chancellor gives up, gets a speech. I never met him. Comes back, he sits beside me, and after a little bit, things settle down. He says, let's slide out. I want to talk to you. So I ease out into the hallway. And he said, tell me about this literacy program. So I explained the whole literacy work to him and how all this is working and the schools we were doing and that we had purchased property adjacent to the very university, one of the universities that he administrates.
Yeah.
And that our goal is to be able to offer services and everything to his students and that type of thing. So he hands me his business card. He said, if you're ever in Ghana, come see me. I said, okay, that was pretty good. Well, lo and behold, I jump on a plane. I fly to Ghana to meet Peter over there because he's there for his mother's funeral. Well, in the meantime, he and I are going to fly north so he can visit the literacy team and see what all we're doing. Well, we walk in the airport. Who's standing there? Vice Chancellor. He's catching the same plane we're on.
Mm.
So he tells, as soon as he does, he has a protocol officer. Calls his protocol officer. He says, hey, I don't know what's going on, but free up my schedule. I want to meet with these men this afternoon. He said, I want to make sure we're taking care of all their lodging and all their transportation needs while they're with us in the north. So I'm immediately calling my drivers and all the contacts I had made to say, guys, I'm not sure what's going on, but things are moving, be at the airport, but I may send you away until we figure out what we're doing. So sure enough, we fly to northern Ghana, we go into his office, meet with him, and I explain the literacy work, and we get more involved, and they're going to agree that they're going to send medical students over to the United States to train in one of the hospitals that we work at, that Peter's working with.
Mm.
Well, after I explained the whole literacy work, he said, wow. He said, you know, one of the things we're big on in our medical program is we actually send our students into the villages to live with the villagers to better understand their medical needs.
Mm.
Then they come back to the university. He said, it's kind of what you guys are doing with your literacy team people. They actually go live in the village. He said, what if we could take some of our teachers that are in our university and we could send them in to work with something like your literacy program? I said, great. We'll help any way we can. So in the meantime, he calls, makes a phone call, and a little while later, the dean of the entire medical program of Ghana shows up in the room. So he gets into our meeting. Well, we're talking, and I'm sharing this literacy work, and he says, you know what? He said, for 26 years, I was the chief surgeon at the medical clinic in Wa, which is the center of where the literacy work is.
Right.
So he said, who does all this stuff? So I said, well, Nancy Ball and Paul Abraham and Isaac. And he said, I know all those people. So I said, wow. He said, here's what we'd like you guys to do. We know you're going up. We're going to take care of getting you there. He said, I'm going to have my entire schedule canceled. I'm personally going to take you. So we leave from now, middle part of Ghana, and we start up through. They've already built one clinic up in Navarongo. They're going to build a duplicate clinic like that in Wa, which is where the literacy program is based. And so they're now asking me, say, is there any chance you guys could help us translate our medical material on diabetes and hypertension and prenatal care into the local language? Sure. And what once we can get our funding squared away, we'd be more than happy to pay for those services and for the consult and a consulting arrangement. So all of a sudden, out of the blue, now this thing's turning in a way that I've got an income potential to support this literacy program. Well, sure enough, the doctor rides with us, and he has a driver. So we're being chauffeured now. And they've got four-wheel drives and all that stuff. And, of course, Peter has always lived in a car as a child. He's never been on those dirt roads and those kind of conditions in the northern. So, I mean, he was seeing part of his country didn't even know existed, you know, type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, we visit the literacy team and all that kind of stuff. And the reason I share this with you is now this board is now twice the size. We not only have the Cook County Hospital for Chicago has expressed an interest to do training for the medical services in Ghana. They've offered to donate hospital beds, wheelchairs, defibrillators, all of this stuff to go over to Ghana. You know, so one little conversation that I had with one of my installers leads to all of this.
This connections.
So, no matter what it is that you do, it's important to share the story.
Yeah.
Because you don't know where it's going to go.
Yeah.
So, in any case, went over and met with Peter, and it's an interesting thing, but as of right now, for example, I'm actually the chairman of the board of the International Medical Support Services System. And this thing is made up of, it has four Ghanaians, but they're actually U.S. citizens. One lady who serves on the board, born in Ghana, went to Switzerland to be educated. She's now in the U.S. She serves as a consultant to some of the major heads of the U.S. government. She's in South Africa right now giving a speech on our medical work in Ghana as well as the literacy work to the World Health Organization. But yeah. our program is international, and we've already been requested from the Nigerian government. As soon as we stabilize what we're doing in Ghana, then see if we can't bring those resources to bear there. So again, you just don't know the reach on things.
Yeah, it's deep.
This is the vice chancellor. We were in his office that day for the visit.
Okay,
and again, this thing is actually set up international. We're focused on Africa right now, but long term, we hope to be able to serve anywhere in the world. This is the Vice Chancellor Peter, myself, and Dr. Durango, who's the head of the entire medical program. When he started, basically probably 10 years ago, working with the Vice Chancellor, they had about, I think, 40-ish doctors that had actually graduated with degrees in Africa, in Ghana.
Ready to come for training.
Ready to go, you know, as far as in the system. The very week we were there, they were fixing to graduate. Their first class coming through the new system was 112 of them. This is one of the brand new clinics that the university just built in Navarongo, and they're going to duplicate this facility in Watt. This is actually where we were visiting the property with the literacy team.
Right.
So
the property adjoining the university?
Okay. Yes, And again, what was interesting is it gave Dr. Durango an opportunity to see that, again, credibility. We aren't just talking about it. This property's owned. They've cleared it. They're farming it until we can move to the next step.
Right.
First opportunity for a micro business that we were assisting with in northern Ghana, again, staggering poverty level. Mud hut, you're living in incredible splendor if you've got a block home, you know, and especially if you got a tin roof instead of a thatch. But our first thing is while I'm up there, I'm noticing, I'm seeing these goats and sheep just roaming all over the countryside. And I'm like, who owns these animals? They're everywhere. So I said, well, everybody does, but they got little marks on their ear or whatever, but everybody knows who owns which one. I said, well, how often do they sell them off for slaughter? He said, oh, no, we don't sell them. What? I said, that would generate cash for people. He says, oh, no, that's like savings account. Somebody dies or we have a funeral, then we sell the animals in order to do what we need to do. Mm-hmm. I said, so I'm thinking immediately, I'm saying, well, if that's the case, what if people owned them, but they could sell them, and it wasn't specifically a savings account?
Mm-hmm.
Because the Muslims in that part of the country use a lot of these animals in their religious ceremonies. And it would also create a relationship then that the Christians could sell to the Muslims and possibly then have an opportunity of witness. So, my first test was, I said, what if we find somebody that you guys trust? I'll get the money together through a microfinance program. No interest rate, strictly a loan, and they pay it back. But I got to understand, till they pay it back, their neighbor can't borrow the money. But it's all based on who knows who, you know, type thing, credibility there. Put 5 sheep in when I was visiting in last August. They now have in basically about 16 months, went from 5 to 21 because of the birth rate as well as they do some horse trading a little, you might say, but that herd's now increased. And now we have 5 sheep herds going in northern Ghana. This little thing right here, this lady borrowed the equivalent of $300 from the microfinance program. Within the first 90 days, she had retired all, probably 80% of her microloan. And this is in some of the poorest part of northern Ghana, just staggering poverty.
So they can recharge cards and some other stuff.
Well, do they have access to the banking and savings up there?
None.
So they just have to keep it and be resistant to lending it to family and friends.
That is correct. See, that's the one part of the thing that we don't have in our structure, because in certain countries, you can't legally create a savings mechanism because of the banking laws of the nation. So that's where the savings groups become important. Now, again, the reason why we're getting these loans paid back so quickly is because they don't want to take the money home. They pay that loan back at a much faster rate than we would even require. But in other words, they're getting it back.
Yeah.
But that's our next step is to move to this group savings process at a higher rate. We're doing a lot in southern Ghana. It's just not as effective in northern Ghana, but the reason I found out why is because men and women would get together and put them in a little group, but then a lot of the men go south to the mines. So all of a sudden, the group dismantles because of the transitioning of people to work.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they come back, then it kind of comes apart. So we're working now to try to put together a thing where when the men leave, their wives stay intact. So as they're sending the money back, then the savings. So we're having to modify it.
Yeah.
But that's part of the thing, you know, we want to talk about.
Absolutely. Gary, back to the sheep and the goats again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what was standing in? I mean, these folks have been doing this since ad infinitum. So what was standing in their way? I mean, they were using them as a savings account, but what else was standing in their way? Because it would seem like that would make the herd continue to grow.
The thing is, what they didn't really look at it as an economic process to produce income. So well, all we did for our group of people is change the dynamic. Yeah, we're growing them. It's an accumulation of wealth, but it's a wealth that we buy and sell. We trade in, where the rest of the whole, you know, culture does not have a process to sell off unless it's an absolute emergency type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's more of a culture thing. It's right there in front of them. I mean, I'm telling you, if you could have been with me, sitting there with Pastor Paul and Isaac and David and all those guys that have been running this literacy thing, they have literally in the last 5 to 7 years administrated hundreds of thousands of dollars that has passed through them to operate all these programs and construction projects. But it just never occurred to take what's right in front of them and turn it into a business model. Mm-hmm. So the things that we would just assume, we just can't take it for granted. It's part of that.
So how often would they sell off? I mean, who did you have that brought the expertise about? Because you obviously didn't grow up in goats and sheep.
I learned a lot about it. I literally got into, I did every study conducted by the European community and the United Nations on raising goats and sheep in West Africa. And basically, I know that there's a 27% death rate amongst the lambs in a herd. There's very specific food in the dry seasons and things. So basically what I did is I compressed all that information. I said, these are the things we have to be guarded of. And so I helped them get some of the data together. Now, some of them, like Paul, Paul was a kid, he was a goat herder. So he had a working knowledge of it. But again, there was never a concept of buying and selling of them to create bigger and bigger. And what we do too, just so you know, like for example, Jacob owns this particular herd. He borrowed initially about $400. But part of what we ask him to do as part of his contribution, he had to have a large enough piece of land. He had to construct a secure place to keep them at night. So he even though he didn't have the money to put in, he could put in his own time, his own energy, and his children were working with it. His family was involved in it. So now they took ownership as part of this process. The loan's interest-free. We projected somewhere between a 2 to 3 year payback to come back in. But what we do, Dusty, is when we want to put a herd on another village, and also I sent over a complete tagging system. These animals are tagged so we don't have an interbreeding problem. So now if he wants to take, and instead of paying that $400 back, and we're ready for somebody to set up a herd in a village 5 miles away, he can take part of those, take them to that guy, get him up and running in business. We will issue him a credit, and that part of the loan becomes the other guy's.
Yeah.
So it can roll on itself, you might say. And so, like I said, we've actually got 5 total herds running now at varied levels. But the real commitment from them initially, because they have no money, is they have to be able to provide the security and the way to keep them. They have to prove their ability to
feed. So you're asking for a business plan?
Yeah, absolutely. You walk them through, and that's part of what we'll get into a little bit, is how you work through that business plan and that business model to understand the true cost. And I'll tell you what's amazing when you get into it, and they were blown away. I typically spend some time on a big whiteboard, you know, in front of them. And you go out and you say, okay, we got one ram, we got 4 ewes. And we spent $100 for the ram, we spent $80 a piece for the ewes. We know that over the course of a year, you're going to have to spend an additional $50 in this particular supplement because it's got certain vitamins and it'll be a better health. So that's a cost. Those are the things they don't understand. So you begin to build that in, assuming you got a veterinary visit once a year. They have like mobile veterinarians, you know, type thing. So that fee once a year, you plug it in, and all of a sudden I said, your cost per animal is no longer an average of $95 per animal. Your cost over a year is actually about $110 for the first year. Now, after the first year, and all of a sudden we have 4 lambs, now I've got 9 divided into that cost factor instead of 5. All of a sudden, my average cost is, say, $70 per animal. Well, when I did the last calculation, my weighted cost, because of all of the additional animals that have been born, my cost is down around $35 to $45, but the going market rate is still $90 to $100. Mm-hmm. So that's truly a creation of wealth, even though it's not in raw cash. Right. And what we do is we give them full credit. Even when we transfer a part of a herd to another village, we give them credit for the current market value to retire their loan.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
See why?
Yes.
Did that kind of answer your question, Dustin?
Yeah. Getting a feel for it.
No, absolutely. And again, like I said, this is a store in just an incredibly rural, very depressed village. And traditionally, most of these little stores you find out there, they're a little closet about the size of this table. In other words, you open the doors on them, there's little shelves. But this is actually a full 20-foot container. I mean, it's very surprising. But like I said, retired that loan very quickly. But the next step is to help them get into a better savings condition in the north as well as we're doing in the south. This is actually where we shipped over the container. We had sent long-handled hoes and farming equipment because the traditional farming equipment is this. That's a standard hoe.
Yeah.
And what happens is obviously somebody bent over like that all day long. There is no way to be as efficient in a farming process this way versus standing up. It was so funny. I'll never forget. I had 45 people in a training class out there in the middle of the village. And we were talking about it. And they said, well, you know, we had some missionaries send some of those long-handled hoes over there, but we cut the handles off. Because they were never shown how you work with a long-handled piece of equipment. I mean, you wouldn't think it would be that complicated, but I literally gave them a lesson because they had no comprehension. They cut that entire field that you saw in that property we purchased with hand scythe, all by hand. So when they seen how a sling blade worked, they were blown away, you know, with that whole process. And what was interesting with Dr. Durango there, he was saying, he said, Gary, you'd be shocked at the number of back injuries in Ghana and neck injuries from the ladies carrying so much weight on their heads, that if we can take and get our people educated how to use this type of tool and equipment the right way, because these things can be produced in their country. They got blacksmith making the hoe bases. Just a matter of putting a longer stick on it instead of a short one. Mm-hmm. But in any case, all of a sudden, that whole farming project, what would have normally been just a massive undertaking, they're able to do it now with this longer-handled equipment at a much more efficient rate than what they could have. So again, it's a lot of little things that you can build into your programs as you're going. This is actually the king I was telling you about when I was over with Peter. We had a chance to meet. He's very interested in John's education program because his was the one that none of his kids passed the test. And so he's actually going to go out to that school. As a matter of fact, we're waiting for him to come to the United States here within the next month or two probably and visit with us, and then we'll set up a program to see if we can take one or two of his schools and engage with them and see if we can move that number on his kids testing and performing better. Now, what we've done, I'm going to walk you through. You were talking about how you take this thing from the dream to the goal to the action plan. Now, I want you to look at something on the scope of this property. And it's staggering when you think about a mission work. But if you look at what we've already done from nothing, the thousands upon thousands of dollars it's taken to acquire the property. And like I said, this is the land that's out there. No, that's one of the corner boundaries right there, that block post.
Okay.
But phase one, here's our action plan. Phase one was to locate and purchase suitable property project. It was $28,000. Paid for. Done. Next phase was to develop the conceptual drawings for a worship center, activity center, all the CAD work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all of that was done because I supplied all of that process. It was no charge. Okay? Yeah. The next thing we needed to do was raise the money to connect electricity to the property, More importantly, drilling a deep well, and I mean a deep one, 800 to 900 feet. And road access is going to take $30,500. Right now, that account has $26,000 in it. We'll start sinking the well within just a few weeks and then bring power in, and the road's usable enough to get the equipment in and stuff. So that's already in motion. Next phase is construction of a worship and activity center. It's going to cost about $95,000. Next phase, construction for the rental spaces on those businesses that will pay rent, which will provide income to run that literacy program. That's going to take about $55,000. Phase six is the three hostel buildings. Because what I figured out was when we breach approximately 160 students paying rent for a hostel on the current rates it is now, it generates enough profitability to be able to completely fund the $40,000 a year and maintain the hostels themselves. Okay? So they're going to cost about $115,000 each. So I'm talking about over $500,000. But you're like, Gary, you're dreaming. That is crazy. But we've already raised almost 100,000 of them. You see? So, don't not dream. You got to be realistic about it. But you got to create a plan. You got to be able to communicate that plan. So, don't limit yourself either in what you can do. And for example, this is design on the property, where we'd have like our literacy buildings up here, hostels on this end, location for well, other retail and business center over here that the students could use. So again, it gives people an insight to where you're going and what you're trying to do and why. Mm-hmm. And I've got two websites that I actually worked through. One of them that shares the literacy project and one that helps through my actual work that I'm going to bring up here a little bit later that we'll talk about.
How many acres total is that plot?
It's 4.5 acres. But it was acquired 100-acre plots. But we got lucky that we could tie it all together by some negotiating and leveraging, you know, in that area. So, but again, the reason I wanted just to share a bit of this with you is that this whole concept right here, it's really important. If you don't know where you're going, it's kind of like trying to drive across the country without a map. You know, you really got to understand where you're getting to from point A to point B. Some things that I thought that might be good for us to talk about a little bit is the ways that we can kind of control these whole financial systems. And we'll make some diagrams of those. There's four ways in which to really help and support missions in financial ways. And those are we'll get into the definitions, but one of them is what's called a ROSCA. And then, of course, the other is a traditional bank. Then there's the Savings Association, and then there's the true microfinance side of things. And this thing kind of runs kind of like those other lines when we looked at self and time. They're kind of at the opposite ends, but they all have their, you know, possibilities. Well, we've already talked about the bank. The bank is almost an impossibility for the average West African person to access. So that's almost non-existent as a usable asset to us, okay? So when you look at the ROSCA, that's kind of what you were talking about yesterday. Whenever you have the group of people, and basically it's that rotating savings and credit association, and for the most part, what that means, and they're typically best in churches, where you get 8 to 10 people, members of a church, And they all get together and they say, hey, we're going to all eat or whatever the denomination of your money is, and we're going to all commit a dollar a week. And they meet and they put their money in and they elect a treasurer for that week. And that person is responsible to take everybody's money. They have their records. They keep up with who puts what in. And then that person takes money home with them that week. And then the next week, they rotate around. So that way, the money's being seen by everybody. It has credibility. But they kind of help reinforce each other to save, save, save. Well, typically what those do, for the most part, is somebody within the group, say one person's a farmer, and he comes up at planting season, but he needs to borrow $10 to get enough seed to plant his land. Well, to try to go to the bank and get that, he can't do it. But he can come to his group, and let's say he's been in there long enough and he's got 20 saved. Well, he can actually borrow his own 10 back. Go through, get it planted, come through harvest, and then put it back if he wants. That's one way a lot of them do it. But it's a great reinforcement tool from one to the other to help each other to be encouraged. Because somebody may have tough times and can only put 50 cents in that week. Well, they only encourage them. Try to get it caught up, you know. So,
How about the security of the money?
Again, that becomes
in their possession.
It's theirs, and that's the challenge that comes from it. There's a responsibility, and it actually teaches responsibility. And obviously, if for some reason they don't feel they can do it, then they have a responsibility to talk to their team members and say, hey, I'm just not comfortable having this in my home. We've all verified this was here, but do you mind if it rotates past me? Again, they've got to have that conversation with each other. But what it tends to do is pull the most disciplined, resourceful people together to accomplish the most within a church organization. The church you saw in the South with the terrazzo walls and the windows, they got three of those running. That's how they started, is that exact process right there.
I'm thinking about themes.
Oh, I understand.
Yeah, and because around here, that's one of the first things that, even in our culture, the police will tell you is don't advertise what you own.
Right, exactly.
Because, I mean, it's just an invitation for someone.
And that's what I was going to have you just jump in on, because you've got some experience. How did you see your fellow countrymen, and from what your parents explained, do you handle that? As far as the security side and the responsibility when they held possession of the money?
Well, basically, it's like you said, you know, if you were not confident about your living conditions, that the money will be secure, you can pass it on to somebody who's, living arrangements are a lot more secure if the money were to come to you. And it's this matter of trust
that
you can retrieve the money from this guy. It's not so, if you would call, not a devourer, put it that way. So you can go take the money back from when you want to use it for the business project that you wanted to. Or otherwise, the treasurer himself had access to a banking system, in which case anything can be returned that way and retrieved back for the group's sake when the next meeting comes around and they want to use the money to give it to the person.
That's
for whom it is due.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to hit on next. It may well be in your area.
Yeah.
Because you may have some local banks, which is what the young lady I was telling you in the South, when she hit all those things, at the time she started that, it was really based off of initially trying to create just a larger one of these outside of a church in the business community. But she literally took the money and put it in her husband's bank. It was just under one savings account.
She got a big enough wad that the bank would do business.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And that's my thing there, why I wanted to open this conversation. You may well find out that you've been a populated enough area that you can do it. But in northern Ghana, there's only one bank in Wa, and most of these northern villages are at least 15 miles. They have no way to get to that bank.
No.
You see. So There's pros and cons no matter which one of these you use. But as far as this type of thing, it can fully be done and started without funding out of the U.S., without funding from a missionary. It can be done totally within their own structure.
The
negative side of it is if they're wanting to do something kind of bold like we did on the sheep herd, it would take years to amass the kind of money that it took to kick off a sheep herd, buy property, put a village, put a farming project. So, again, what we did in that environment, which takes us over to this side of it, the microfinance, because, again, we didn't want to be a bank. We didn't want to have to deal with the government issues associated. So we said we're going to support a microfinance fund. But it's going to be a gift of the money. But the combination of local pastors and just people with a good community involvement, you know, just people that you can trust in those areas, they absolutely control the decisions on who has access to that money. So they're taking some responsibility, but you know what? I didn't want none of those local pastors to be collectors. I don't want to create or damage their Christian thing as debt collectors either. So it's like we told them straight up and said, look, we know you will use the best decision-making that you know how. And you know what? If somebody makes a mistake or something goes wrong, we do not want you to jeopardize your integrity in the process, but we do need you to try to maintain the accountability so they are diligent about who gets a loan. We had one situation, and what didn't even really come out of the microfinance, but I'll share this with you, because it came up in one of my training sessions while I was there, in which, during this thing, this guy told me, he said, well, Brother Clark, I thought I was going to have to go to see if I could do a micro loan. He was a deacon in one of the churches. He said, but I needed to buy the seed and the fertilizer for my farm, and basically he borrowed, the supplier agreed to provide fertilizer and seed for the equivalent of about $100. And they had a drought just staggering. This was 2 years ago, staggering in northern Ghana. It went on for about 6 weeks longer than normal. So basically, he had done a lot of work, but that it burned it up in the fields. It just didn't grow. And so we were talking, and he shared, he said, I just don't know what to do. He says, I've been able to pay back $40 of it, but I'm still out the $60, and I've just exhausted every means I have. And he says, I'm not worried about me being able to pay it back as long as it takes or whatever it takes. But what I am absolutely concerned about is my Christian witness and how that looks possibly to me. And I don't kid you, that's a tough thing whenever you're standing out there and this guy's almost in tears because he's worked hard, he's willing to do whatever it takes, and he says, I just don't know whether to try again or what to do. So I had an opportunity to chat with some of the other people that knew him well and without him realizing it, and they said, yeah, Garrett's really a shame because he really worked hard. It wasn't for lack of effort, it's just strictly the weather, it's an uncontrollable thing. And normally I don't do this. But I was getting ready to go climb in the vehicle to get ready to go back. And I'll never forget this. I opened the door and I put my hand right up on the top to slide into this four-wheel drive. And I just stopped. And it was just an incredible, incredible weight on me. I mean, you just felt like your chest was being pressed. And I was by myself. So I said, you know, Lord, are you telling me something? Am I supposed to do something while I'm here? And I'll never forget this overwhelming feeling to say, you know, it's like, Gary, you need to talk to this man one-on-one again. Is there anything you can do? So I went over and I talked to him. I let him walk me all the way back through all of his business models, all of his hopes, all of his dreams, all of his plans. Did he just miss anything in this thing? And when we got through, I'm sitting there thinking, I said, couldn't have done this any better myself. So I just told him, I said, I really feel like I'm being led to try to help you. I don't know why or what. And I said, so I reached into my pocket. I didn't know what I had in there. But I just reached in my pocket, and I had one crisp, brand spanking new $100 bill. It wasn't converted to Ghanaian money or nothing. I don't know why I even had it. So I pulled that out. I said, I just feel like I'm supposed to give this to you. And all I ask of you is to retire your debt and do it again. Just go again. It's just, you know, the weather. So when I was back over there this past year, he had retired his debt. He started over again. And from what I understand, from what everybody told me, just an incredibly successful produce for that year. So I don't have all the answers to it, but that's why there's sometimes there is an appropriateness, I absolutely believe. But I will tell you, most people that do this type of stuff will tell you, shouldn't gift, you shouldn't do. But when I get back and I can show you the story of that daycare, and I can tell you the story of what this meant, it's, you don't want to create a dependency from it, and I completely understand that. But also, you don't want to leave in place, I think, such a hopelessness either that people can't dream and look for a way to overcome something. So I think there's rare opportunities for that type of giving, but it must be sparingly and it must be controlled. Okay? Now, if we talk about this type of thing, this one just keeps the people's money moving, rotating amongst themselves, keeps the credibility. They basically borrow their own money back and forth. And it's an encouragement. It can be built around, like I say, a church environment, so it has a good Christian base. Therefore, it brings a lot of credibility. This one is traditionally Christian-based around churches, but this one is actually set up in a way that it pays interest. It charges interest as a savings credit association. And it can actually loan to a non-member if someone has good integrity in the community and they just want to create, and then every so often everybody gets their money back, the dividends are paid on whatever was earned, and then they start again if they need the money. Some just leave their money in and just take a dividend. Some just keep reinvesting. So, and obviously the thing that I showed you with Ruthie and Derek, that's on a much greater scale even, because, of course, they're loaning to primarily business people. And normally when it gets over to the finance scale, that's when it loses its ability to be as driven from a Christian witness program unless you do it the way we do it. But it's very controlled to the Christian community in northern Ghana, too. It's very selective. So, like I said, there are reasons to stay away from this, but we have proven it can be managed if it's done in a certain way, which I was absolutely told it could not be done. And I didn't do it to prove them wrong. I just felt that we absolutely had a group of people that could manage that. And you may well have the same. So does that kind of make a little sense? So far, guys?
I'll tell you what helped. Okay. I'm just trying to think of a, like putting those on a chart.
I was actually going to do that tonight. I was going to take this other program and put it together for you so that I can email it to you and we'll have a few more handouts. Normally, I can't get this far, but because you guys bring a dynamic to the table, it kind of helps to speed things up just a little bit. But yeah, and I'll put in the various descriptions of all of these different types of things. And of course, the other ones that I've got here for you give you all the pros and cons we talked about yesterday. So it'll kind of tie it together for you, if that sounds all right.
So how do you get money into the system from the States to Ghana? I mean, do y'all have access to the banks there in Ghana?
So what we did.
And then through that access, you...
Yes.
So the people that contribute money to these efforts can rest assured that through that bank, there's nothing
That's
untold or nefarious in that banking system.
Right. Yeah.
Now, one of the things that is the big perception here, as you well know, is that everybody that I'm aware of that has access to the internet has received these con letters from Nigeria.
That's correct.
And people are deathly afraid of contributing money to anything that has to do with Nigeria. And that's wrong. How do you, or how do we go about assuring people that when they contribute to their church, and that church is in turn going to send these monies to Nigeria, for example,
mm-hmm.
how do we set something up in place, or what way something that could be set up so that
sure.
they can be assured that this is not a con game.
Right.
This is going to replicate what you've done in Ghana.
Sure, what we did at our church and what was built, again, within Ghana, and you want to look at this in Nigeria, is we took and went to, fortunately, we had an attorney who was part of our, he is actually raised and came up through the literacy program. And he's one of the most world-renowned attorneys of Ghana. He actually does all his stuff before their Supreme Court and stuff. So he is always wanting to give back as far as to what helped him as a child from that literacy work. So we went to him, and he made a recommendation to set up what is known as the Fundamental Baptist Church Ministries. And that is chartered in Ghana. It has a legal banking account. And we have the capability of wiring funds directly in from our church, works like a board from the U.S. for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, all funds that are donated go directly to them. In other words, like all the administrative costs for me to fly over and do what I'll do, my company funds all of that. Nothing is taken away. When it comes to like my pastor going over or our chief financial officer that goes over periodically to do our thing, our church funds all that. In other words, that's part of our mission work to them, is we support that administrative expense to drive it. But literally, we have that whole institution set up. So that was something, I don't know how it is in Nigeria, but we certainly need to talk about to make sure whatever you're going to do that controls any of these entities that is of legal charter or whatever's necessary, you know, in Nigeria.
I believe that, you know, his church, if it's registered in Nigeria, that registration number, you can open a bank account to that church.
Absolutely.
And use it for their transactions.
That's right.
Like me now, I have a personal account in Nigeria.
Yep.
And if I wanted to wire funds to it right now, within 24 hours, I can call my brother, check it, be sure it's credited, and it is credited, and it can be U.S. funds or the local currency.
That is correct.
And
so, sometimes through if you do that, is there some sort of a charge that you have to pay? You know, like, is there...
There's a banking fee that they charge over there, even though I've already paid a banking fee here, too. Right, I mean, costs me... $35 to send $5,000.
Right.
But if I go to Western Union, they're probably going to ask me about $300,
$400.
Right. So I don't use Western Union since I can use my own personal account. And that reduces the cost.
Exactly. Part of the thing at what I do, and I'll scroll through this is my website, Helping Through Business.
Okay.
And what I try to do is help people to understand, you know, why does a businessman, for example, go to Ghana? Because part of what I try to do is for other people in my position that own their own companies or through their own philanthropy or whatever, what are you willing to do to give back to humanity?
Yeah.
You know, type thing. But as I was saying earlier, there's a lot of people in the business world that aren't driven from a Christian dynamic or belief system. Now, they're good humanitarians. They want to share.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's one reason, as I got involved with the whole medical side of this thing, most of that is really driven because people want to help, but they just want to make sure, like you said, the money gets there.
Yeah.
You see? So part of this whole thing for us is geared around this integrity side. And you got to make sure somewhere between 80-90% when you move off there, because you truly do have administrative costs to run these things. But you want to make sure you can prove most of it is truly getting to the people you help. Because unfortunately, there's a lot of stuff, less than 10% gets to the people that really need it. It's just a big front game.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, that happens here, too.
Absolutely.
Organizations here. So. Right.
But you see right there on the top of mine helping people, where 100% of your donations go to the project of your choice and what I do. So for people looking at my website, whether it's drilling a well or whatever we do, and then I tell them a little blip down here on, you know, why I go to Ghana and you know, what we do with that in the microfinance system, small business development, the literacy programs, all of this is shared. But as part of this, what I do is I go in, and this is the story, for example, in northern Ghana,
mm-hmm.
with the, you know, where they can see photos and things of what's going on with the literacy work and the sheep herds. We're raising, one of the projects is raising chickens over there. Now that you see the stores and the different things there that are out there. Then I go over and I talk about what's happening in southern Ghana, where, again, some of the things you've seen from the micro businesses, the daycare center, the computer lab, you know, what all the resources we're providing there. Then this is in Bolivia and Peru that we're working with, where you see the orphanages there. They actually have the ability of raising 8,000 chickens. They have chicken houses, but because they didn't understand how to control the risk of disease and the things, it can be tough raising chickens.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a very fast profitable, but it can eat you alive in a hurry. Well, they tried doing it, and they got hammered with a disease over there that destroyed it, but it's like I told them, they're also raising hogs and stuff. But the cost of corn went up dramatically, 3 times. So all of a sudden, they couldn't sustain their chickens, they couldn't sustain the pigs. I said, you got acres and acres around you. Can you lease this property and grow your own corn? Following year, they're growing their own corn. So now, and they leased out their chicken coops. So now they're bringing in income from leasing those facilities. Their hog herd has doubled or probably tripled in size by now, but they're growing their own food source.
Mm-hmm.
But now those kids are being taught a way to make a living as farmers and is maintaining the kids, take care of the pigs, and all of those things that go with it. So, you know, the website tells a story about that. And then, of course, I've got an area where I have a lot of videos and, you know, pictures and things like that, where, again, I'm just trying to communicate with people what we're doing over there.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
And then, of course, I have it tied back to our you know, work that we do. But you're right. It's critical to make sure that there's a mechanism within your church or something that is legitimate within the country, that those dollars are routed and it can be mapped back to it.
Well, one of the things to create that level of certainty is if you meet a national like this and you start working with, or the fact that Dusty has been to visit and establish the integrity of this man. Or you meet me like this here, right, and I'm saying, right, I've been going back and forth in 12 years of missionary work, and what is my heart? Once you establish that, it will eliminate what we call the 419 people that send those letters. And, of course, there has been what I would call God abuse in my country, in the sense that, you know, young graduates can put on the gown and cap and, you know, for example, I read a story about them going going to a miracle crusade, mm-hmm. and then bring fake people to testify that they were healed of ear, this yeah. and that. When those people didn't get paid money, they start trouble and they say, the police came and they say, every profession has its own tricks. The doctors have tricks, pharmacies have tricks, so we're just doing the tricks of a profession. So God gets put on the tricks side so that people will come and donate money, that miracle is going on in the crusade. So it's...
Well, I think what I was asking, I guess, is that financial side of the need here for these things, is that potentially something that Horizon International wants to get involved with as far as being able to provide those services, not just for their organization, but for other missionary groups that want to do similar work?
Yeah.
You know, they all have the same need of yes, trying sir. To get money Absolutely. Into the country.
You know, most of that, I think, boils down to what do you have huh? the people, resources that can manage it.
Is that today?
Because, you know, for me, I work a full-time job, but this is almost a full-time job, too, you know. But we've got a structure in our chief financial officer.
Because I was about to leave the 7
We tried to break it down within reason. But it just depends on how big and far. But for the most part, where we come a bit to is it's theirs to run.
Right.
We help them get there and get control over it. But really, it's not for us to make those decisions because they know the people. I just want to show you something on one thing.
Maybe I'm thinking like the same problem like we've always thought. I'm just stuck in it.
In other words, this is, for example, what we set up over there for the Fundamental Baptist Church Ministries program. This Excel spreadsheet runs everything from every micro business. It runs the literacy financial structure, the widow's fund, the pastor's fund. But every month, we get this report back. So we know where it is. And again, it's not for lack of trust, but it's mainly, too, to say, hey, are they struggling with something? It's like for themselves. I don't know if I can find it or not. But, you know, they didn't understand that what we did as part of their program, we figured out, we said, you know, we're asking them to go into the communities and teach a savings process. But they really don't have a savings process within their own organization to prepare for emergency. So we said, you know what, we're going to see if we can raise a little bit of extra support just to create a savings program for them and see what they can do with it. Well, I looked at this thing the other day, and all of a sudden, there's probably $15,000, $20,000 sitting in that thing. So what it's telling us is just because they've got it, they won't waste it and spend it, you know, type thing. So, but they're hesitant even through an emergency. Like, for example, we had a situation where we got a call. There was a young man in one of the northern villages that was having some kind of a tumor. He'd had a problem since he was a child. But they couldn't get him. Northern Ghana, he had an authorization to go to a hospital. They couldn't get him from northern Ghana either into Tamale or Accra to the hospital. Transportation was a major issue. Plus, when he went, even if he could ride the bus, which is only $10, but his parents needed to be with him. They didn't have a place to stay. So, again, it's a whole issue of how you do. So, I said, look, I'm not sure what's going on. Deborah and I just immediately wired $200 over. So I knew that would at least get his family there, get him there, and find out what's going on. So we get a report back about a month later. They've gone in, they've removed this growth back out of him. He's doing extremely well. Family was able to be with him through the period, getting back. But if you stop and think, a $200 investment in an individual just changed that teenager's life forever. Mm-hmm. Where otherwise, it would have just deteriorated, and probably would have died at 50, like right. most do, you know, unfortunately.
I'll give you one, this, that Kennedy told me the other day. The people that we treated at the medical clinic the last time we were over there, five of those people have now passed away as a result of not having medication. Simple, renewable medication. And you're showing here, CY handles all the financial arrangements. He makes he strikes the deals and takes care of all that. And Dr. O'Carey and Clement, Dr. O'Carey's uncle, who's over there, has handled. So having somebody on the ground, I think, is what you get back around to, where you got accountability that is there. You know things are going to, like back to what Upong said about the, you know, knowing and having that trust level that you know that it's going to be taken care of. The part that is really that I think for CY, I'm just talking to Don about this a minute ago, is just creating the rest of this infrastructure out in the, because I can see, you know, CY, I was thinking about that first one up there, that Roscoe, that rotating thing. I can see in some of the very remote villages where that would be an easy.
That, right. And that's what
that'd be an easy thing. Right. You know, bam, you just need somebody to come in and train and then come back. And then you have another, you know, because you're training up levels of things. But I want you to know that's something that CY is already doing with, he's got, I don't know how many guys that he pastors and others that he's mentoring right now.
Dr. Ogden.
How many, CY?
Dr.
That he already has these relationships with in all of these places. So. When you said that, you know, when you sat down the first time with me and you kind of laid this out, that's why.
Yeah, you know. Absolutely. And that's what I'm saying. You tend to find, whether we were in southern Ghana, whether we were in north, you find these infrastructures within the Christian communities are somewhat there if they just understand how to utilize the resources, you know, type thing. And the only reason I just wanted to bring this up is, again, the whole credibility issue. And it's not, we have never been asked for this, but I make this information available to anybody that wants to see it so they can see that basically, you know, we have a summary of their accounts. We know what their salaries are. We know what their taxes, the literacy center operations. Like right there, as of this month, the literacy center is operating with over 20,000 CDs, which is equivalent of about $9,000 to $10,000. Okay? And they built that up because they just don't spend everything just to spend it, you know. It's not that they wouldn't like to. We had a bookstore running at one point, but due to a conflict on being able to continue to rent the property, it just couldn't justify itself due to governmental issues and things like that. So we withdrew and we held the money because we're going to reopen that bookstore on our own property when the time comes.
You know, Gary, I got one question for you. While you got this up?
Yeah.
You know, back on the chart over there on the microfinance. Yes.
Right.
All right. The principal difference.
I appreciate the call back.
The principal difference between the microfinance and the credit association. As far as them borrowing the money from that, what is it?
Okay. The microfinance, there's two versions of microfinance. There's a traditional version, which that means it's out somebody else's money. They're putting it in. It's like me taking my money and saying, I'm willing to let you borrow this as a lending institution. You loan it out. You will earn interest, and you'll charge enough to pay all your expenses and pay me a dividend. And But that typically doesn't have a high ratio of any spiritual context, you know, as a rule of thumb. It's a true money-making business process. But what it does do is in some of the poorest parts, it can infuse cash very quickly because they don't have, it's slower to raise it this way amongst the individuals.
So you've got investors.
You've got investors in a traditional. What we chose to do was our microfinance, we gifted the money to our literacy team, basically. All those men you saw are part of the board of directors of this institution there. But that money was gifted for us to never make a dime off of it. Okay? So, but they treat that money as if it's theirs, and obviously they guard it closely to who it gets loaned to, and it is loaned at zero interest
rate. Zero interest.
And we have made a commitment to them to say, like right now, rate of depreciation of money right now is at about 22% right now, at the rate that the dollar's deteriorating, okay? So I know that for every 20 cents on the dollar we have gifted them, when that money gets paid back, it's going to be worth 20 cents less. Mm-hmm. But as I travel the country and I explain this concept, I tell everybody that straight up front. We just got a gift for $7,000 in December to use to continue to funding this microfinance, promoting new programs as well as offset the depreciation of the money. Mm-hmm. You see, that's the whole other side of this. And our model is by no means traditional. And every book you read will tell you, don't do it. Don't go there. I'm just saying, I think there's a time and a place that it can be utilized if you got a CY on the ground. Like we have a Paul or we have a John. They do the same thing.
Yeah, those things, you're right. They don't factor in the tremendous trust and the sweat equity, the investment of the people part of the...
That's the dynamic. They can, since they can't put a measurement on it, they don't take it into the account of the process because they can't measure that relationship of the process. So, like I said, that's why there's two dynamics to this microfinance. There are microfinances all over West Africa. As far as going through traditional means and borrowing $100 and a loan, that money's readily available all over the place. But what happens is these microfinances, again, are normally constricted to high population areas. Yeah. Because you, in order to make money at this, you got to have 10,000 loans where we're dealing with less than 20 right now, for example. You see? Mm-hmm. So, and again, they typically don't reach 75% of the people that really need the help, and typically it's always focused strictly on missions work. Now, you know what? We have actually had people come to us and borrow through the microfinance, through the team, because they had a medical emergency or there was some need. So we don't limit it to a business, but again, it's very guarded to who the individual is and the risk that it wouldn't be paid back for some reason. And again, not because we want anything, I just want the money available to loan to the next guy that wants to build a sheep herd. Mm-hmm. Okay?
The kind of revolving loop.
That is correct. It's just a cycling process. Absolutely. For example, you saw that picture of the chickens on my website there. That's one thing that makes some money as long as you don't get, you know, if there's no disease issue. But for example, Isaac, you saw in one of those pictures, he got an idea. Before he had to move off the compound, he said, you know, I'm going to try doing a flock of chickens. So he bought 20 of one breed, 30 of another breed, and these were basically, he was going to sell them to like restaurants or whatever. Hey, sounded like a great idea. So for about $100, he got these 50 chickens. All he had to do was raise them about 10 to 12 weeks, and he was ready to sell them. So I asked him, I said, you know, Isaac, you're getting pretty busy, you're getting close on your time, you're going to have to move out. Would you be better off to take a little less money and go to a wholesaler, sell the whole batch out at one time. Let him deal with the distribution. You take a little less, but you got yourself out of this thing before you have to leave. So sure enough, he went out. There was a wholesaler. Wholesaler bought it. He only sacrificed about a dollar per chicken. It was minimal. But he walked away from the thing. Not only had he paid the cost of the entire flock, all the food costs associated, he hired actually another family member because he's doing his ministry work to actually take care of them on a daily basis, paid all his labor expense, and then when he was done, he had actually almost doubled the investment for raising them, and it was all done in about 12 weeks. So, Deborah...
I'll take them on
absolutely, any day. So Deborah took, because of her concern for the national pastors, so part of her thing was this, I guess in January, she said, you know, Gary, she says, I got a couple of the savings bonds that we had gotten years and years ago, and they're just not doing nothing, but they're going to mature, and it's just not doing anything. He said, I'd really like to take that money instead of buying any more bonds or whatever with it. I'd like to convert it, send it to Isaac, since he had such a success, and go to 17 of the fellowship pastors, not the church pastors, but the fellowship pastors, and put two chickens and one rooster in each one of them's family, and just see what they can do with it and how that would possibly go. And so far, we've only lost one rooster, but they had enough funds in their thing, they've already replaced that rooster for him. So again, it's not always about thing, it's about the lesson learned. It's about the process and teaching these lay pastors and other pastors these same concepts, but in a scale they can touch it and feel it. That's one thing I find in Ghana, and I'm sure you guys run into it too, is that even though we have put up schools, we have built homes, we have done all the things, the land that you see, because even with these men being at it for 20 and 30 years, Pastor Paul, he told me, he said, Brother Gary, so I look at this property and I look at all the things, the farms and everything going on. He said, but you don't know how hard it is for me to believe that this still won't come true. Because it's not built yet. You know, he said, it shouldn't be that way, but our culture and the way we have lived so long, it's very hard for us to see this in our mind. So be patient with us. Help us understand and those kind of things. So you really have to kind of be guarded of how you help people, you know, see those dreams and goals as part of it. But again, I just wanted you to see this, see why. In other words, like, this is where we were paying the rent on the literacy center and some of the things we do. This is where they pay their vehicle insurance. This is like we've got a vehicle maintenance one. We got that widow's fund, the pastor's fund, the school fees for the little children, the miscellaneous. There's a benevolence fund, savings. In other words, that's their savings account. That's worth about $2,000 in U.S. dollars right now, you know, type thing. So I just wanted to share with you, it's important, whatever you guys do, to create an absolute method for tracking where the money's going and what's going on with it. Because that is absolutely imperative to the credibility of whatever you're going to do.
One question that I've had is on the Rosca, where the money is held by a group individual. I mean, it's kind of silly. How do they keep it? Do they put it in a box
bag?
I guess one question I have is there anything that we could give them that would make it a little bit more secure for them like a locked bank bag.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's possible. The main thing I would say is what's available in country to work
For example, in Nigeria, there are people who run this microfinance business. Mm-hmm. And to make sure that the refund is done as at when due, sometimes some people attach some little legal means to it, a kind of an agreement whereby a lawyer will write, before you not take the loan, you will go through the lawyer's write-up, sign as a kind of surety.
Sure.
So somebody's standing for you. Then another means of me, because one can be, I can be honest, but the people I now release the fund to may be another thing. So one of the things is to attach little
legal
means, as I have said, and interest, so that some people will now, to avoid the interest being accumulating, they will now begin to rush to return it as at when due. And then another way to protect it is that, if, for example, I may now come and say I need a loan of 200,000. I will now ask you, what are you going to do? Let me have your spending plan.
Basically. And you're right. In other words, this basically goes in and it says, what research and development have you done to look at your market area? What have you done to look at, you know, what are the benefits of it? What are the non-benefits? What's your risk? Is it going to oversupply market area? Good. You know, because there's already one bread seller here in the community. Do we really need another one? Or do we need the competition to increase the volume of sales? So then we get into the, you know, developing their business plan and then what's required to start the business. What's going to be the name of it? What are the government requirements associated with it? And what's really interesting is when you look at the startup costs, as we were talking about earlier, what are the government fees, the tools, equipment associated with it, material supplies, advertising, just the things we just take for granted. And I know you going through all this stuff. You know, do I have a utility bill for water? Do I have a power bill? How am I going to, you know, what's that expected to cost? That's where we have the greatest ability to do good for people considering how to use these tools, is to get this as part of the process. And it has to be part of the financial training. But in order to determine who's got the discipline to pay that money back, it helps to see who has the discipline to save. One leads to the other, and in reality, is what happens. But, and I'll tell you the other side of it that's important is also I do a lot of work, not only from this part of it, but in the same way, what family planning, and help them actually to take that business concept and look at their own family budget side. Mm-hmm. Because all of a sudden, if you can impact their ability to manage their own personal finances, the success there grows dramatically whenever you put that in place. So, you know, I ask them the question, well, how much does it cost you to live? And they'll sit back and, well, I don't know. I said, well, how much does your electricity cost you a month? How much do you normally spend on food? Things, you know, we go through. But because, again, most of them are operating from a day to 2 days or a week at best, tend not to pre-plan and think about what it really takes. And then all of a sudden, when you really find out and say, how much are you spending on your cell phone cards a month? And it would mind-boggling. Sometimes, see, they have really no idea what they're spending because the cell phone has turned into a status symbol in a lot of those countries, too. So a lot of their disposable income is actually being consumed by something that's not really necessary.
Blame it on them.
So the personal finance aspect becomes a very important, you know, part of it, too. Now, like I said, a lot of places, with the accumulating savings and credit union. That's just mainly a ROSCA, but it has an interest driving boundary to it. It's a money producer for the group that does that. Again, none of these are right, wrong, or invalid. It's just what fits the best, you know, for what you're trying to do.